Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Hi there. I am Carol Jurgensen Sheets, a.k.a. Carol the Coach, and I am glad to be with you this evening. You know, the question is, not only do you want to change, but do you have the proper supports to change? And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. You know, there are so many resources out there for you, but you may not know what they are. And I suspect that you may not know what they are because this is a topic that you have not talked about with other people. And when you don't talk with the right people about this issue, you're probably not going to get the right help. But I sure am glad you're listening to Sex Help with Carol the Coach, because this is a show about strength, hope, and recovery. And I interview some of the best people in the world that have expertise in programs that can actually help you to turn your life around. It's all about, what are you willing to do to make your life different? And it isn't easy. You know, if you have a sexual addiction, if you have compulsive hypersexual behavior, if you have tried a million times before to stop the behavior and you continue to end up in the same place, in the same way, then you probably suffer from sexual addiction. And there are criteria that you can go to a certified sexual addictions therapist with, and they'll let you know where you are on that spectrum. You can take specialized tests that will assist you in understanding what type of sexual addiction you have. You know, there are 10 types of sexual addiction. And I'm going to talk about a couple tonight. You know, I deal with men and women that are addicted to porn or addicted to infidelity. They have multiple partners. They have anonymous sex. They have difficulty maintaining intimate relationships. And, you know, for instance, a professional that I know was currently working with several guys in his group who had addictive behaviors where they masturbated in public in their cars as females walked by. They spoke about being addicted not only to the masturbation, but to the danger and excitement of their particular type of behavior. You know, they talked about that adrenaline rush, that charge, that excitement lit up their being. We call it the reward center of the brain. And they couldn't figure out what was going on because that hit, that behavior that activated the reward center of their brain oftentimes was more sexually charging than the actual masturbation and voyeurism that they experienced when they were in their car watching women. You know, they also commented that oftentimes that behavior just was not in any way comparable to normal sex. You know, normal sex with the partner just didn't get it for them. And so as therapists, we want to know, you know, how do we short-circuit this addiction to danger and excitement and adrenaline? And oftentimes we look at early traumas. And yet sometimes the client will say, I didn't have any early traumas. In other words, when sometimes we look at what we call sexual reenactment trauma or trauma reenactment, our clients aren't able to remember or identify what may have caused this charge as a child or in early adulthood. Now, we have some experts in the field, and the Center for Healthy Sex explained that danger and excitement are dopaminergic states, and they tell our addicted clients that the seeking system, which is housed in the central nervous system, is constantly activated. Now, that then lights up the reward center in the brain. So you've got the central nervous system greatly affected, and then you have the circuit that goes directly to the brain, the reward center. In neuropsychological terms, this ties into arousal in the peripheral nervous system, leaving hyper-aroused, high-alert states. And at the same time, the reward system that's deep in the midbrain is blazing dopamine, which overrides any higher cortical functions. It's not the seeking, not the acquisition of the reward that makes them feel good. They're actually addicted to their own neurochemistry. And what happens with these kind of clients is that they are on the hunt for novelty-seeking, high automatic arousal, where they can have excessive dopamine and glutamate production. Now, when they have this kind of dopamine release, it can often create neuronal fatigue and the creation of tolerance. So guess what happens? As this continues on and on and on, and clients look for more and more reasons to feel that adrenaline, that hyper alert, that charge they get to the reward center, their tolerance also increases, just as if you were a drug or alcohol addict. So as you can see, what looks like deviant behavior that's atypical, is really also a physiological response. And so you're not just looking at the behavior, you've got to look at what interrupts that neurochemical response. And that can be very tough. That's why Patrick Carnes has said to us, hey, we oftentimes have to become neurochemists. Now, not really. We're not neurochemists. But we have to look at the neurochemistry of the brain to figure out what we can do to interfere and interrupt that cycle. And that will then help us to figure out what we need to do to help somebody who has both a voyeuristic sexual addiction and an exhibitionist sexual addiction. Remember I said there's many types of sexual addiction, and voyeurism and exhibitionism are two types. Anonymous sex is a third. Exploitive sex is a fourth. And so... you need a specialist, a certified sexual addictions therapist who is trained in this. And when that occurs, I'm here to tell you, you will have that right combination to get maximum help for your issues, but you have to feel comfortable being able to talk about what your issues are. And truly, not every therapist out there can help. So I want you to go to sexhelp.com and put in your zip code and find a therapist who has the training to help you. I cannot highly recommend certified sexual addiction therapists enough. And let me tell you, sometimes you can get help in intensive outpatient treatment, in regular outpatient treatment, in group therapy. Sometimes you have to go through residential treatment. And there's nothing wrong with that. You may need a double dose of getting away from your environment, concentrating solely on yourself, seeing if there is some trauma reenactment occurring, working with your family members in an area separate from your own home. And when that occurs, there are so many good treatment centers out there. Now, tonight, I'm going to be talking with Deborah Schuller, and she works for Pine Grove, and she's actually the program director for the Gratitude Program. And we're going to be talking tonight about what is addiction and when do you go residential treatment, how long does that occur, what can you expect. And this is a specialist from Pine Grove, and Pine Grove is one of the top centers in the country. So I'm really looking forward to working with Deb and talking with her. And, you know, you too can feel free to ask her questions by calling 646-595-3284. She's a recognized specialist and certainly puts together programming to make your life better. And there are no questions that we can't handle. They're as certified sexual addictions therapists. We've heard it all. We're here for you. We know that you feel shame and blame and guilt, and we know it's a difficult subject, and we just want you to know that you have a safe place when you look one of us up, when you get treatment from us, or you go into residential treatment center. So I can highly recommend the different modalities, but you've got to seek a certified sexual addictions therapist or a certified sexual addictions treatment center. So welcome to the show. Deborah, is that you?
Hi. Yes, it is.
Hi. Yes,
hello.
You are really a specialist here, and you're willing to talk with us a little bit about sexual addiction and what are the definitions and how do you go about getting the help you need. So I guess I'd like for you to introduce yourself a little bit and talk about Pine Grove Behavioral Health and Addiction Services, as well as your specialized program, which is the Gratitude Program.
Okay. Well, my name is Deborah Schiller, and I am the Program Director of Gratitude, which is Pine Grove's sexual addiction treatment program. We also treat other intimacy disorders like relationship compulsivity and sexual anorexia. We look at sexual trauma. And then in relationship to that, we look at addiction interaction with any other compulsive behavior you might have around chemicals, eating, gambling, workaholism, all of that, those other isms that can go along with any type of addiction. So we're located down in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and we're part of a bigger system. We work through Forest General Hospital, which is our big regional hospital, but the behavioral treatment wing is Pine Grove. And so there at Pine Grove, we have different programs for chemical addiction and eating disorders and professionals' issues and sexual addiction as well.
Well, yeah, and Pine Grove is very famous because you've treated some very important people, and you've had Dr. Patrick Carnes, who worked
mm-hmm.
diligently with you on and off over, I can't remember how many years.
10 years.
It's been A decade.
10 years. He when he was ready to set up his own freestanding sexual addiction program, he came to Pine Grove to do that. It's on its own campus, and he wanted to have a place specifically just for sexual addiction, whereas other treatment centers at that time treated sexual addiction in with all the other addictions. He wanted to have a place that was his treatment center for specifically sexual addiction. So he liked the way Pine Grove was set up so that if we had somebody that needed to focus on some chemical issues, we could send them over to that campus, or somebody that had some professional issues or some licensing or personality issues, we could send them to that part of the program and thus and so. So he really liked that setup. And and we've really enjoyed working with him over the 10 years. He built up a fantastic program, wrote lots of books while he was there, and did research, wrote, you know, lectures and that type of thing. And so we still have a good working relationship.
Well, and what we know, and our listening audience may not know, but clearly when you have sexual addiction or hypersexuality as an issue, more than likely, you have another addiction, whether that be work or eating, gambling, financial disorders, drugs, alcohol. There's almost always at least one, if not many, other.
Every once in a while, somebody comes in and all they have is a sexual issue, you know, but more likely than not, there's other things. And Dr. Carnes is one of the first people to recognize that, say, an addiction to prostitutes is one thing, and addiction to cocaine is another thing, but there's a separate thing that happens to your brain when it's prostitutes and cocaine together, or it's, you know, I'm just thinking of other types of behaviors that you might have, like drinking and going to strip clubs. Each one is its own separate addiction, but when you do them together, it needs to be treated together and not just separated out. I think a lot of times people look at the chemical use or one of the other behaviors and treat that and don't go down and ask the hard questions about the sexual behaviors, and then they're confused about why the person relapses because the sex addiction was never treated. So they go back to treatment centers over and over again because no one ever looks at the compulsive sexual behaviors.
That's right, and so that's why it is ever so important to be able to work with all of them at one time. You may deal with them separately, and you may work with them separately, but they, if you don't treat the sexual addiction and you treat the alcoholism, the sexual addiction will get worse, and vice versa.
Right. Yeah. And at Pine Grove, we really believe in treating all of the addictions at once, that you, when you come here, you can't smoke. It doesn't matter what program you're going to, you can't participate in any of your other compulsive behaviors. If you have a compulsive relationship going on, that we need to deal with that. You're not going to just come in and address, make be a drinking problem, and we realize that you have all these other things going on, and we just send you home without addressing those. So it all gets treated at once.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because certainly the old school of thought was, if somebody had a drinking problem or a sexual addiction problem, we let them have those other addictions because we felt it was too much to expect them to curb everything at once. But now we realize that one is a gateway for the other, and so if you don't,
you absolutely have to help
people not smoke.
Exactly. You're exactly right. And the neural pathways in your brain are still firing in the addictive way. If you're smoking cigarettes out in the smoking court, then you go in and you go to your primary group, or you go to a lecture, or you spend the whole time you're in treatment not drinking or not looking at pornography or whatever it is, but you are continuing to reinforce those addictive neural pathways in your brain by smoking cigarettes the whole time you're at treatment. It's very much more likely that you're going to relapse, because those never were able to heal.
Well, and I had a client that went to Pine Grove, And he didn't think he could give up cigarettes. And he said for the first time ever, and he had certainly tried over three decades to give it up in and out of that. But there were doctors that helped him with that. There was smoking cessation kind of exercises that
patches.
He did. He really got intensive treatment for that, too.
Right, exactly. We treat smoking. There's no smoking anywhere on the Forest General Hospital or Pine Grove, any of the campuses. So everybody, there's nobody around you who's smoking. We don't have caffeine. We're in the business of healing your brain while you're here in all aspects.
Absolutely. Now tell me a little bit about the program in which you are the program director for, the gratitude program. What is that?
Well, people who come to our program generally have some type of compulsive sexual behavior, or they may be compulsively non-sexual. They often will have sexual trauma. Some people have never been in a sexual relationship in their whole life, but they compulsively look at pornography, or they compulsively fantasize, have sexual thoughts all day long, and it's just making them feel crazy. They don't know how to relate to other people because they can only talk to people in chat rooms or, you know, looking at images on the Internet, people kind of what we call screen addiction, where they don't know how to be with a person in the same room, but as long as they're looking at their phone or their iPad or their computer or their television, they can, you know, be with people in that way. So there's all different types. I heard you talking about this at the first part of your show, that all different types of sexual addiction. But when a person, generally a family member, it's a loving family member that says no more. Often the addict is afraid to reach out and ask for help because their brain is telling them, you can't stop doing this. At all costs, you need to continue this behavior. And even though you want to stop, you promise you're going to stop, you believe you can stop, it's something, because it's a brain disease, you can't stop on your own. So generally, people have tried working with a therapist. They've tried the 12 steps, which we do 12 steps very rigorously every single day. So we are a 12-step program. At the same time, sometimes it's not enough that a person just has got to get out of their environment and go to a safe place where they're not going to have computers around them. They're gonna be living with people who are staying sober one day at a time. Sometimes the people, they've gotten into so much unmanageability in their life that they just call into our call center and decide that they want to come on in, that they have just, not that they've been working with therapists that long or trying to do it outpatient, it's just that they have not been able to make themselves do it on their own. They need a jump start. And so then we'll bring them on in and then get them to a good CSAT therapist when they leave.
Well, that makes total sense. And so that's called the gratitude program.
Right. So what we do when a person comes to our program, they have a full psychological evaluation. So generally during their first 3 days that they're there, they're meeting we have two psychiatrists who are also addictionologists who work with us. We have a psychologist and a postdoctoral psychology fellow, a psychology intern, and a psychology extern. And they're all working together, interviewing, testing. They're taking the sexual dependency inventory, the MMPI. So they're having personality evaluations, sexual evaluations, the PTSI for trauma. They're taking the MWASI for the money and work issues, and filling out lots and lots of kind of telling their story, interviewing the different psychology staff. And so then they get a full we work up a full treatment plan for the person with problem areas and the things that we're going to do to help them address those problems. And each person has a unique treatment plan. They're assigned to different primary groups, and our primary groups generally have 4 to 8 people. You can average around 5 or 6 people in your primary group generally. And that's where you do the bulk of your work. And the work that you do in there is the work that stays in that group. They don't talk about somebody else's work outside that group. We encourage them to talk about their own work, but they're practicing anonymity, you know, keeping somebody's story anonymous. They do tell their story to the whole group as soon as they feel comfortable doing that. They work on a timeline. They do a trauma egg, which you know about, I'm sure, but it's where they talk about their family, their roles in the family themselves and their family rules, and then we look at things that were less than nurturing that happened to them throughout their life that might have impacted their addiction. As you know, I'm taking this off in different areas, but there's a biological underpinning to this disease, but there's an environmental part of it too, that we need to look at some of the drivers of the addiction. And so
I was going to say, you know, you're talking about all the ways that you really diagnose and assess somebody so that you don't miss anything in residential treatment. And that is the beauty of going away for 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. What is the average day for somebody who goes to the to Pine Grove?
Well, there are workshops there. So if somebody can only get away for a week, we have a Facing the Shadow workshop where they just get a really good all day long for 5 day dose of this and can come back and get a jump start on their recovery. If they come into the gratitude program, that would be a minimum of 45 days. But people often stay for 60 or 90 days once they get there, and they really realize they have a lot more work to do. And but it would be for a minimum of 45 days.
And I know that's probably possibly scaring some of the listeners, thinking, oh, my gosh, I could never be gone for that amount of time. But it's been my experience that people that went into the gratitude program, they needed at least the 45 days, and they were able to manage that. Employers did give them FMLA. Family members did say, get this thing worked out. This has destroyed my life or our life, and we need you to get healthy and take as much time as you need to really make it a 60-day, a 90-day program. Do what it takes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And often when the addict stops and looks at how much money and how much time they spend on their addiction and how their life has just become tortured, addiction is really suffering. I've heard people say, oh, yeah, sex addiction, that's the disease I would like to have. You know, they think it's a lot of fun, but it is really suffering. When you start hearing these people giving their first steps and talking about the lives they've ruined, the marriages that have failed, the times they've been fired from jobs and all the promises they've made, and they just could not quit their behaviors, it's so sad to hear that and how miserable their lives have become. And when you think about how throughout their lives they have been developing these neuropathways and the way that their brain thinks, to think that you could, you know, change that overnight is really impossible. They need to have the time. You can see them in about their 14th day. They get to their 21st day. They're starting to come up for air. Their eyes are starting to focus again. They're coming back to life, really. And they're starting to think more clearly. And then as they're there for, you know, 30, 40 days, there's a real difference in their ability to make amends to their family, to hold themselves accountable, to really get honest. As you know, with addiction, everybody tells lies in addiction, and you just addicts often get very comfortable with telling lies. It's how they think. And to start living in truth and being honest, it's so refreshing, and it's just, it's wonderful to see people's lives change and marriages being healed and families kind of being put back together and the forgiveness that starts to happen. So
absolutely. Now, let's just go back to the very basics.
Okay.
From your perspective, what do you think, how would you describe the definition of sexual addiction?
Okay, so sexual addiction is when you have a pathological relationship with your sexuality. So there's, you can have two different people who are behaving in exactly the same way, and one is a sex addict and one isn't. So you can't just look at somebody's behaviors and say, okay, check, 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 that person's a sex addict and this person isn't. But you, what you do is you look at what's going on in their lives. And so this person over here perhaps has a spouse who is very comfortable with the sexual behaviors that person has chosen, has the same kind of needs for sexual outlets, that their morals align with one another and the behaviors that they're doing fit in with their moral values. They're able to hold down their jobs. They're, it doesn't seem to be getting in the way of their relationships in their life. And we're not out there trying to drag somebody in because they're doing a certain sexual behavior that we disapprove of, that we're not in the business of judging what anybody wants to do sexually. But the other person over here might be doing the same thing, but it's eating away at him. I say him, it could be a her. It goes against their values. They've burned through several marriages. They might have been fired from several jobs because maybe they're looking at pornography on the job, or they're up all night doing their sexual addiction and they don't make it to work or whatever like that. They're blowing through the kids' college fund and they can't stop spending the money. They've lost all of their friends. They've stepped out of all of their community activities. They're living an isolated life. No, their kids won't speak to them anymore. I mean, their whole life has become completely unmanageable. And that's the person that we want to help. When they come to us and say, you know, help me, I can't stop, I'm ruining my life, I'm at the end of my rope, then we can help that person. And we'll say,
but
this person has...
that is the difference, isn't it, between...
Mm-hmm.
Just having a sexual issue, you know, being more interested in sex than other people, and people where it's absolutely become unmanageable and it has ruined lives.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's so sad often to see the state that someone's in by the time they get to treatment. But the wonderful thing about it is that families, once they can really wrap their head around what's happened, there's often anger, there's shame, there's pain, there's fear, there's a lot going on. But when you really get the truth of what's going on and understand the biological brain disease of sex addiction and live in acceptance, okay, I can't change what's happened, I can accept what's happened, I can look at this for what it really is, then the family starts to heal and the family gets into therapy and starts doing their work and understanding how they've been traumatized by trying to love someone who is not available to be loved. I mean, they're just, when you're a sex addict, you are not available to be in a relationship, and your family members are trying to love you and be in that relationship, so they become very traumatized and need their own care as well.
Well, absolutely. Now, do you think people are born with a predisposition to sexual addiction?
See, that's a very interesting question. I think that people are born with the genetic makeup to become an addict. So they have shorter dopamine strands in their genetic makeup. They have shorter D1, D2, D3, and D4 dopamine strands. So they have fewer dopamine receptors in their brain from the day they're born. And they experience life in a different way. So people that have lots of dopamine receptors, dopamine being that chemical that's in your brain that gives you a sense of well-being, of satisfaction, of happiness, that people that have plenty of receptors for that chemical, can you know, run and play in the sprinkler and get excited about the Christmas presents and, you know, be happy when there's a new baby in the house. The child that's born with fewer of those just don't quite get it. The same kind of sense of the world is a good place to be and I'm a worthwhile person and people care for me and love me and those types of things. So they look for something outside themselves to fix that. And one person might grow up in a family where there's alcohol around and they sneak some alcohol and boom, all of a sudden their brain is flooded with dopamine and for the first time they're feeling that sense of, yes, I belong, I can do this thing, life is good, right? Another person might have access to an internet where they see pornography or there might be Playboys lying around or whatever it is. Different people, someone else might grow up in a family where food is the thing and so they gob onto that is their the thing that really fills their brain with dopamine. But of course, when you're flooding your brain with all that dopamine, your brain starts to absorb some of the receptors, even when you're born with two, not enough. So after you've had the big drink or you've had the big sexual experience or ate half the chocolate cake or whatever it is, then your brain, you know, diminishes in dopamine, then it has even fewer, and you feel that hangover and that horrible feeling of, I'll never do this again, this was a bad idea. And so as you're in your addiction, you're damaging your brain. You're continuously damaging your brain. So the first thing that people need to do is stop. Stop doing what they were doing to hurt their brain. Stop all the things that they do to hurt their brain and start letting it heal. So your question being, are people predisposed to be sex addicts? I think people are born with a genetic, you know, kind of roll of the dice that they could become an addict of some kind. And then we're not sure exactly why people end up being one type of addiction over another, but it's the same disease.
Well, absolutely. That's exactly mm-hmm. what I believe in. And mm-hmm. certainly, there are a lot of people that say there is no such thing as sexual addiction. There are a lot mm-hmm. of people that mm-hmm. say it's not a disease. There aren't DTs. Mm-hmm. There aren't significant withdrawal symptoms. Mm-hmm. And yet anybody who works with folks that have this illness,
right.
they know that this is compulsive behavior that's not stopped. There are actual withdrawals or DTs, they're not the same as
right.
with alcohol or drugs.
Right. You know, one of the worst withdrawals of all the addictions is to relationship addiction or love addiction, because our brains are so wired to be in relationship with others or to be in love, so to speak, that mm-hmm. when there is you're torn away from a person, that you've got this, you know, somebody who is what they might call a love addict. I kind of hate that term because it implies there's something wrong with love, and I don't think it's really love. Like Dr. Carnes' book, don't call it love. I think,
right.
But it's where you have to have several relationships going at once because you're afraid that if somebody, you don't ever want to be alone, or you kind of can't let go of this one until you have another one set up to go to, or you're just so enmeshed with the person that you're in a relationship with that the rending and the tearing apart from that is just excruciating. And most people can identify with having broken up with somebody you're in love with or losing a loved one to death and how painful and horrible that is. Well, if you're an addict and you're addicted to the person, this is not just loving somebody. This is, you know, using that person as a drug. It's even 10 times more excruciating for that person to go through withdrawal, and you see people doubled over in pain and sobbing and, you know, every pore of their body is screaming.
They can't sleep and they can't eat.
Right.
They aren't able to function, and they're sitting mm-hmm. outside somebody's driveway for 36 mm-hmm. hours straight just waiting for that person to come
right.
home and really exhibiting
right.
very bizarre behavior that is absolutely, it feels uncontrollable to that person.
Yeah, They're completely out of control, and you can get arrested. You can get charged with stalking. You know, there's just all kinds of things that can happen. People can put out restraining orders on you, and people end up voyeuring, watching out for that person. They're completely obsessed with it, and it just controls their life, and they can't do anything else but be obsessed with this person. So that person needs treatment in the same way that a heroin addict needs treatment.
Well, that totally makes sense, and obviously that's one of the reasons that you don't feel that it's a choice. When people get to that state, whether it be love addiction, sex addiction, it's no longer a choice. It feels mandatory to exhibit those behaviors.
Yeah, it does. The, I know I'm sitting across from an addict when they come into our program, and I just tell them, you know, you can't do that. You cannot do that anymore, and they just start crying. And it's as if you told them that one of their loved ones has just passed away. We look at addiction as an attachment disorder, and the person attaches to the behavior or to the chemical, whatever it is, in the way that someone would attach to a person. So it's even in a relationship addiction, you're more attached to the behavior of being in a relationship than you are to the real person. Now, that person might not be good for you at all. You know, it might be really bad for you. And yet you still keep going back.
Absolutely. So now let's go back for a second, because treatment for love addiction, for sexual addiction, for hypersexuality, whatever, can be diversified, but how would you describe what the normal treatment is in a residential treatment center for, let's say, sexual addiction, and what are the options?
Right. So what we do, I mean, is the options of different types of treatment or what we do in our program?
What do you do in your program?
Okay, and then I can talk about other types of options. But in our program, the person would come in, and then we say we do that evaluation, and they'd be assigned to a primary group. Generally, they wake up in the morning and have their breakfast. Then they go in, and we have a time of meditation. So it's a 30-minute time where they're quiet. They can they can pray if they want. They can meditate. They can sit quietly. But it's a time to get centered, to let other thoughts leave your mind. And everything we're doing is trying to get the person's brain to heal and teaching them skills and being relational with others, because sex addiction has robbed that from them, helping them grow up because, you know, in addiction a person stops growing up. Really, they're very immature often. So after meditation, they will have community, and the community is the time where everybody, all the staff and all the patients come together every day, and they talk about, we go around the circle, and each person says one thing that they're proud about themselves that's happened in the last 24 hours, some kind of growth that they've made, or some kind of an awareness, or something they've done for another person. Often in addiction, the person shames themselves all the time, and their self-esteem is through the floor. So we want them to really think about the things that they are proud of, that they can see themselves in a good light. And also in the morning they do affirmations where they say, you know, just like in our growing up, we might hear negative messages about being worthless, and those form certain neural pathways in our brain where we're easy to go to that when we make a mistake or we do something that's outside our morals. We immediately shame ourselves because we're used to hearing those old tapes. So we're writing new tapes. So they'll do affirmations, giving themselves positive messages. They're changing the way they think. And then in community, they're learning how to share who they are with other people. An addict, of course, does not want anybody to know anything about them as much as possible. If anybody knew what I was thinking, that they would not love me anymore, is one of the core beliefs of an addict. So we break through that and have them share when this happened, this is what I was thinking, this is what I was feeling, this is how I relate to what I'm seeing, just sharing who they are in community, holding themselves accountable when they do something that goes against their own treatment progress, really, and giving other people affirmations, those types of things. And then at the end of the group, we go around one more time and say one thing we're grateful for. And there's a lot of research out right now about gratitude and how people who live in a place of gratitude have happier lives than people who are not aware of the things they have to be grateful for. So that's a big part of our program, is reinforcing this lifestyle of living in constant gratitude. From there,
but say that, Deborah, because I just wrote a column about the fact that there are three bullets or three indicators for happiness, and they interviewed 20,000 people, two of which had been through the Holocaust. Several of them had houses burned down. Many of them had been divorced. And they said to be happy, they all had three qualities. One was that they stayed in the moment. And, you know, if you think about self programs, they ask you to live in the moment.
Right.
And then, secondly, have gratitude, to look at what's working as opposed to what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then that third one is reframing. When you look at something, a tough situation, an obstacle, a barrier, a problem, and you ask yourself, well, how did I grow stronger from this? Or what does this have to teach me? And it takes you out of that thick state, and it empowers you. And that's what your program's all about. It's about empowerment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's so foreign to most of our patients when they come in that they can be happy, that they can have happiness, that they can live in the truth, that they can reframe. You know, it's kind of this grievance story that they've had about how life is unfair and all of that stuff. Well, you can turn that right around. I mean, some of the things we say when we go around the circle that we're grateful for are some simple things like clean water, the fact that the sun rose this morning, the fact that I have family who's missing me right now. I mean, instead of going, oh, I'm away from my family and I'm sleeping in this strange bed, you know, you can say, wow, I'm so blessed to be able to have the wherewithal to come to a program like this. I'm so lucky to have a family that misses me, or even to have a family that's angry at me right now. You can have gratitude for so many things. So I really like that article that you're talking about. So I'm glad you wrote that. We're looking at positive psychology. We're looking at, you know, turning people's lives around so that they can live that happy, joyous, and free that the 12 steps talk about.
Absolutely.
It seems impossible some people.
Does your program offer to do the intensive work that they need to do?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, so then when they after community and they have a little study hall, then they'll go into their primary groups. And in their primary groups is where they really dig down deep and they do the heavy lifting, so to speak, of the program of people writing out their timelines, where they spell out all of their sexual behaviors in their entire life, the sexual things that happened to them and the sexual things that they committed, and get honest, probably for the first time in their lives, really, telling things that they've never told anybody, the things that they swore they would go to their graves telling. And the thing about it is, you can work with an individual therapist for years and not really get to the nuts and bolts, because you have 50-minute hours and you come back next week and do another little 50 minutes. And if you are doing this all day, every day, and you're sitting in a circle of addicts who are also being really honest, you get up your nerve in a way to be able to tell every bit of it. And sometimes we use the a therapeutic polygraph as well, so that people can sit down with a polygraph examiner and spend an hour or two talking to the polygraph examiner about, you know, all the things that they feel like might trip them up on the polygraph. And then when they pass the test and they know they've been honest, it's just such a wonderful feeling that they have. And so, you know, that in there, they also do work around trauma, and they're able to talk for sometimes the first time, about things that people did to them growing up. And generally, people have had sexual experiences that were, they were way too young to experience, that were frightening to them. It might have felt good at the time, but it was overwhelming. It flooded their mind in a way that they really started focusing on sexuality at an early age through no fault of their own. They do their first step work where they look very closely at how powerless they've been over this. And that's the point where they really get it, that I have a brain disease that I can't not have, and that's why I've made all these bad decisions. And and then generally in the afternoon, they're going to lectures, they're doing art therapy, psychodrama. We have a ropes course where they do team building with one another. We have a specialist that comes in and works with them on diet, exercise, and sleep as it relates to addiction. And so there's all kinds of activities, and then they have 12-step meetings every evening. And we have a spirituality director that works with them on a weekly basis of looking at the spiritual nature of life and their lives. And really everything we do is imbued with spirituality. We don't talk about religion, but there's something bigger than us going on in every group, in everything we do.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, so many of my clients that have been to Pine Grove feel mm-hmm. they don't want to leave. You know, they have felt that security and sense of safety, and mm-hmm. they're scared to go home because mm-hmm. they've gotten to discover themselves, and they're like, is it safe for me to be me when I
right.
get out? So tell me, what does the average person, what can they expect when they're leaving mm-hmm. treatment?
Okay. So some people will go home. Sometimes their spouses realize that they need more time to heal, and they'll say, I want to be in a different room from you while we get 90 days of sobriety. I want to wait until I get a therapeutic disclosure, and so I know what I'm choosing. Sometimes the spouse will say, I want to live in separate houses for a while. They might end up living in a house with somebody else who is in recovery while he or she gets some recovery under their belt, so to speak. And their marriage can do some couples counseling and heal their marriage. Some people will go to a halfway house or sober living type environment where there's just a whole facility of people living in recovery. They might have jobs, they might be going to school, but they go to meetings together. They might do intensive outpatient work where they have 3 nights a week where they work all day, but they go 3 nights a week for 3 hours each night or 2 hours, something like that, of treatment, and get an individual session. But they just surround themselves with recovery. Part of what's so scary about leaving treatment is that everywhere there's sexual images in our world, on billboards, on the sides of buses, on you're flipping through the channels to find something that's you won't have a strong sexual response to, and you just see these images. You open up a magazine. It's just really everywhere. And so they've been safe for a while and not exposed to that, or just the way people dress, it's all very difficult, but they have different options. We always make sure they're connected with a CSAT therapist in their community. Hopefully there'll be at least an individual session a week, and hopefully a group session as well, because we know addicts do so well working in groups. We have a relapse prevention plan that's a thick booklet that they work on from the very first day they get there. They're working on relapse prevention from day one, and they have planned out every hour of their day for their first 2 weeks that they're gone. They have they're connected with a gratitude alumni or alumnus. the thing is, our program, having been here for 10 years, we have a lot of people out there in cities all over the country and in other countries where we can, a person, when they come to treatment, they'll start communicating with somebody who already went through the gratitude program. And then when they leave, they can, that person is waiting for them to take them to a meeting. If they travel to another city, they can call somebody who went to our program and meet them for dinner and go to a meeting with them. There's almost every night of the week, there's a meeting going on the phone, a phone meeting for people that have been to gratitude programs. So they're all speaking the same language. They all know how to hold each other accountable for things. It's a very powerful thing. And one thing I did want to mention before I go is that once you come to gratitude, then four times a year you can come back for 2 days at no charge for the rest of your life and get a recharge and share some of your experience, strength, and hope with the other patients who are there. And that is a very powerful, we call it Days of Hope.
Yeah, that is incredible aftercare. Mm-hmm. That is so many free opportunities for treatment and follow-up and support and connection.
Right. So, and then we have a big alumni weekend once a year that's been very well attended. And I think that once a person has been kind of to the bottom in sex addiction, there's so much shame attached to it, and it seems like such a low bottom that they do stay more connected maybe than people that have come to treatment for other addictions, that they've been by the time they come in often. And now they have people that they'll know for the rest of their lives, and they really do stay connected.
Well, and I know that for some of my clients, when they have not been doing so well, they went to their fellow residential treatment friends because they knew that they had hit rock bottom, and that's where they had ended up, and that's where they got the most intensive help, and that's where the anchoring is, so they feel so connected, even so more so than fellowship sometimes in a 12-step program in their own city or town. So it is amazing the kind of work that you offer. Now, we just have another minute, and I am, our listening audience, I'm talking with Deborah Schiller, and she is part of the Pine Grove Behavioral Addiction Center, and she actually is the program director for Gratitudes, a specific program that helps sexual addiction. And if you need to find out more about Pine Grove, Deb, can you give us your website and the phone number for our listeners?
So you would go to www.pinegrovetreatmentalloneword.com, pinegrovetreatment.com, and you'll see all the different things. And there's a place where you can click on gratitude, and it'll show you pictures of the cottages where the patients stay and things about it, answer lots of questions about our program. And then if you want to call, we have a national call center that is staffed with counselors around the clock. And I'll give you the phone number for that. It's 888-574-4673. And if you call that number any time of the day or night, weekends, whatever, a counselor will be on the other end to talk to you about what you're going through. If Pine Grove isn't the place for you, they will help you find the place that is right for you. If you just have questions about this disease, and sometimes they'll call me and say, here's a person that's got some questions I don't know about, and I always say, let me talk to them. And it might be a spouse who is just terrified and at the end of his or her rope about the person that they're married to, and they just need some help, and it's hopeless for that person, and I'll help them find support in their community for them, you know.
Absolutely,
so they can survive.
I want to reinforce that we've been talking with Deborah Schiller, and she runs the Gratitudes Program, and the website is Pine Grove, and it's pinegrovetreatment.com. And, again, that national call center is 888-574-4673. 4673, and you can talk with a counselor day or night. You know, Deborah, I can't emphasize enough what respect we all have for your center, I mean, and your program specifically, because it is designated for sex addicts. I want to thank you so much for being on the call tonight and sharing your information with my listening audience.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it, Carol.
Well, fantastic. We'll talk again soon.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. All right. And as I say to you all, every night that I'm with you, you fearlessly need to have the courage to be yourself. Don't stay in shame and blame, but live for tomorrow by getting help today. I'll talk to you next week. Have a great one.